to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. We are here at the Telephone Booth Art Gallery. The Telephone Booth Gallery was established in 2010. It's located in the Junction, burgeoning West End Toronto neighborhood, and the gallery exhibits contemporary Canadian and international artists. The gallery director, Charlene Rankin, has a keen interest in nurturing emerging talent with a focus on materials and process-oriented works. Currently at the Telephone Booth Gallery, Visual Residue. It features recent paintings by Paolo Fortin and print works by Tim Lauren that explore the ephemeral qualities of recollection and memory, transience and isolation. You can go to telephoneboothgallery.ca, and we're very appreciative that they let us do this here. We are here, Jim and I. Jim, you want to say hi?
Hello. How are you?
Okay. We're here with Sakura Saunders, and she is an organizer for protestbarrack.net, an all-volunteer online network of groups researching and organizing around mining issues, particularly involving Barrick Gold. And Sakura also co-founded the Mining Injustice Solidarity Network in Toronto, which focuses on creating a platform for mining impact communities to share their stories in Toronto. We're also here with Brendan Soares, and he is the drummer and co-songwriter for the Toronto-based politically-driven prog rock band Slide, and he's also been interning with the Mining Injustice Solidarity Network since September 2012, and is currently in his final semester in the Community Worker Program at George Brown College. Welcome, and thank you.
Thanks for having us.
All right, so Jim, take it away.
So maybe you can begin by telling us individually what led you to do this work.
Sure. Well, for me, my journey started as an activist when I started working actually at my college radio station in Davis, California, and going to this media reform conference where before I had a critique of the music industry and a critique of radio, but that was my main focus, you know, in terms of radio and media and things like that. I went to this media reform conference, and I found out that there was a much bigger critique of the mainstream media to be had. And that was the fact that there's all these social movements around the world that didn't have access to the mainstream media, which itself was extremely biased towards the elite, towards the status quo, towards their advertisers. And I kind of got radicalized over this weekend. Later, I started working for a group called Corporate Watch, or Corp Watch. And when I was working for that group about 7 years ago, I was always attracted to mining issues because the critique, when you examine all these different case studies of mining, was always so clear, a very clear anti-capitalist critique, a very clear anti-state critique. It was the same story over and over and over again about a corporation getting together with a central government in some country and, you know, working it out so that they could exploit the lands of the rural poor and indigenous populations. And so I also knew that with mining, no one ever talked about this. You know, you don't go to the Barrick Gold store to buy your gold watch, right? You know, they don't have these easily accessible retail outlets that make them talking points in everyday conversation. And so working at Corp Watch exposed me to this, and then while I was at Corp Watch, in 1 year, I just happened to meet three impacted communities, all impacted by Barrick Gold, by the same mining company. And by the time I met the third, the first was a lawyer from the Philippines that was representing the community of Marinduque, who had a lawsuit against Barrick. The second one was this ex-president of a mine workers union in Porgeran, Papua New Guinea, in the highlands. It was crazy that I got to meet him. I met him at a radio conference, actually. And then the third one was a Western Shoshone elder in Nevada. And by the time I met her, we were like, something has to be done about this company. And we started strategizing that night and decided to go to the shareholders meeting in 6 weeks. And the shareholders meeting was in Toronto, which is where this company is based. And that was my first time ever in Toronto. going to the shareholders meeting. I got arrested. I got beat up by the police. I later sued. It was this whole crazy...
Wow, welcome to Toronto.
Yeah, a crazy, crazy series of events. It was actually really beautiful. The Weird Jury from Australia, an Indigenous community there. The Western Shoshone from the States, they accompanied us as well. In our delegation, and because I was there with two representatives of these two different nations, six nations hosted ceremonies for us, and I was a fly on the wall to these Indigenous communities from Australia, US, and Canada, all coming together, meeting each other for the first time, which was incredible. They have extremely shared histories, you know, of residential schools, of genocide, of all this stuff. And it really opened my eyes to the fact that mining issues are so closely related to Indigenous issues.
What year was that?
That was 2007.
2007. How much coverage did that get in the mainstream media?
Zero. It was actually interesting. We got front page in Now magazine, so yay for Now. Mm-hmm. but otherwise, actually the first 3 years I came here with Impacted Communities, we got zero coverage. In terms of, they wouldn't even, like, say that the Impacted Community members, who all got to speak at the mic at the shareholders meeting, we gave them proxy shares, so they were able to go in and ask questions. All the reporters saw that they were there to ask questions, but none of them reported even on their presence, let alone what they said when they did get the mic.
How strongly do you attempt to reach out to the media?
Oh, we did phone calls, press releases, media advisories before the press release. It was an insane media blackout. In fact, once the shareholders meeting was actually in the CBC building. But later, I mean, it's crazy to think about. But it's a story of persistence, right? Mm-hmm. You know, 4 years, I believe, after our first time in Toronto, we made... front page business section, Toronto Star. I remember one of the years, 2009 actually, they didn't report on us, our presence at the shareholders meeting. But within a few days of starting the Barrick tour, Barrick had housed police in Porgera, Papua New Guinea, who burnt down an entire hillside of houses. And we had pictures of a hillside of houses on fire. And so that, the current of the CBC covered that, because that happened 2 days after we started the tour. We were getting these pictures from Papua New Guinea, and it was just like breaking news.
And what about the coverage in Papua New Guinea of something like that? Local media there.
The local media does cover it.
Yeah.
For sure. I mean, there's a big report called Porgera in Flames, and you know they actually do a fairly good job of reporting, but it is difficult because Papua New Guinea is a community of, you know, 700 different languages. It has a lot of different autonomous cultures to a certain degree. And Port Moresby, even though that's the, you know, official capital, doesn't have that much power outside of the capital. And, you know, but in places like Porgera, there is a lot of attention in terms of police attention and things like that, because the Porgera mine makes up so much of the government's funds.
Mm-hmm.
But anyways, so that's how I got involved, and my first time in Toronto, I realized there was no grassroots group working on this. Some church groups had some history of working on mining issues, but, you know, there was no OCAP for mining. No one is illegal for mining issues. And I was like, what? The majority of the world's mining companies are based here, so... I decided that I would move someplace closer to Toronto. At that time, it was Philadelphia.
Mm-hmm.
And I came up every three-day weekend that I could, and I tried to get a group started. And what I found was that there was many people, for example, people that were expatriates of different countries, like in Latin America and things, that found themselves in Toronto, or lots of grad students who, when studying their grad work, you know, ended up in a place like Guatemala and encountered mining firsthand. And these people, you know, all had their experiences with Canadian mining and knew that it was a huge problem, but didn't have any group to work with. And so really the start of the Mining and Justice Solidarity Network was we decided to put together this conference at the University of Toronto. And all the people that came together, that had to come together in order to throw this conference, kind of stayed together and started meeting on a more regular basis and doing things like movie screenings, speaking events, protests occasionally. We did a lot of vigils in the beginning because, you know, unfortunately there's always cases of anti-mining leaders, like community leaders, being assassinated when they speak out against the mining company, and things like that. So we would hold a lot of vigils because we were thinking the vast majority of Canadians don't know about this reality, so we might want to hit them a little softer with some education before we hit them hard with the big protests and things like that. But we did both.
Wow, that's quite a journey from California to Toronto.
Mm-hmm.
For this cause.
Yeah.
Wow.
I mean, if you want to fight mining, Toronto is a place to be. I would say Vancouver is a runner-up, and Calgary's up there as well, and then maybe London, England is a good place, and Perth, Australia. Those are the real centers, and maybe after that, South Africa as well.
Well, you got to be good at something, right?
It's a tourist slogan. And Brendan, what about yourself?
For me, I kind of lucked out. This is all kind of, it was like all new to me, you know. I started my program at George Brown College, community worker program, and really like it. At the beginning, it was just like a plan B, you know. Like I'm 28 years old. I've been doing music for 10 years, and I was kind of like, I need to go. I felt like inside me that I needed to go to school for something, you know, just to have like a degree to kind of fall back on as a plan B from doing music, you know. So I took this program, and that's besides. Like it had, at this point, it had nothing to do with any experience or mining or anything. I just, it kind of seemed like a suitable program for me. And then over the course of my first year in the program, I started for the first time ever taking like politics classes and basically just politics classes, even sociology classes and things like this that I had never taken before because I came from like a math and science background. So anyways, through this all started kind of like to started, I just became aware of all these things, like, and then, at about January, I found out about an organization called, Global Youth Volunteer Network, and they're like a university-based organization here in Canada that send, youth volunteers across the world to just basically get like a cross-cultural exchange. It's not religious, it's not, it's purely to establish relationships with people on the other side of the world and stuff like that. So, so last May, at the end of my first school year, I went on a trip to the Philippines. We went to a remote island called Sibuyan Island, which is in Romblon province in the Philippines. And our main goal when we went there was to do... we were basically going there to run programs. There was like a youth program that we were running just to kind of give like the youth self-esteem, kind of like just to build themselves up. The woman who was housing us was a very like strong leader in their community. And through her, she kind of, this was all like in the back scene of why we were really there. Like, we were staying in her house, so we spent a lot of time with her. And through that, she taught us about all the conflicts that they were facing and the type of work that she did and the reason why she was like such a pillar in her community. And all of this had to do with a mining company that was on their island, and that was basically a conflict for like, at the time whenever I was there, it was like a 5-year thing within their community. So she was working to basically kind of break that down and throw the mine out.
And how was she doing that?
Well, that's the thing, like, she's limited in what she can do, you know. She, basically just building awareness, mm-hmm. She speaks out, she attends, like, the, when the mining companies come to town, like, I'm not sure how she attends them, but she's basically the community leader that goes there, and she was the one who was signing papers, like, to have them evicted and stuff like that. However, I'm not sure how she became that person in the community to take care of that stuff, but she did.
And she had no fear.
no fear. Like, this woman is unbelievable. Like, because, like, she shows up in places, like, where she knows that there may be a threat, right? Because, like she said, like, the security of the mining companies are very aggressive, I guess. Mm-hmm.
And they also... Someone was assassinated in this
area. Yeah, so... previous to her was another, like, I guess, community leader who was murdered by the security of the mining company. And that kind of, like, just kind of gave her more, because it was her friend, right? So that kind of, I guess that's how she stepped into the plate. Okay, she felt like, I need to, like, finish where this guy left off, right? So, you know, just with us staying at our house, it was, like, to me, it was, like, the perfect opportunity. Like, we gained so much knowledge that, like, I thought personally, like, going there, that I was going to be, like, contributing something. And whenever I returned, I felt like I had gained so much more than I could have ever given to these people, you know, mm-hmm. because, like, we learned about the conflicts that they're in and just, like, how important it was to them for us to come back to Canada and basically tell their story, you know. Like, that's what she wanted more than anything that we could do. The most important thing she said, like, just don't forget about us and go back to Canada and kind of, like, let people know who we are, we exist, and we have these struggles, you know? So with that, I came back to Canada in June of last year. And because I was entering my second year of school, part of our curriculum, we have to do, like, a placement for the full year. And I thought, like, okay, so, like, I just had this amazing experience. I made a promise to a friend that I just made that I would come back here, I wouldn't forget, and I would do everything I could to share her story, right? So through other friends and whatnot who kind of do the same thing in Toronto, I was hooked up with Missin, and I emailed them over the summer, and I was like, I just had this amazing experience in the Philippines. I need to have a placement for my second year community worker at George Brown College. Is there any way I can do an internship with you guys? And then Sakura messaged me back, and she said that would be great. It was something new for them. It was something new for me, and that's kind of how I got up into this kind of work.
Great. Fantastic.
So maybe you could tell us a little bit about why it's so important to do this work in Canada, and especially Toronto, at least in the last decade or so. Canada has become the world leader in expropriation around the world, and especially expropriation by multinationals that use Canada as a home base. Mm-hmm. So we can talk about the sort of shift in Canadian policy towards mining and how that makes us the most important place for this work to be done.
You know, just talking a little bit about Canada's presence in the global mining industry. Definitely, as you say, not all the mining companies that are registered in Canada are even really, truly Canadian. They register here because of all of the subsidies, the lax regulations, you know, basically all the things that make it such a favorable climate for the mining industry. One such example is the fact that there's absolutely no laws within Canada to prevent their mining companies from abusing human rights abroad. And there's been attempts at laws, but they've been lobbied, you know, very harshly against by the mining industry, who's extremely powerful. I mean, look at the University of Toronto, supposedly, you know, one of the most prestigious public universities, so-called public universities in all of Canada. And their School of Global Affairs is named after and actively supported by Peter Munk, who's the chairman and founder of Barrick Gold. And in fact, the founder, like the founding director, I should say, of the Munk Center for International Studies at the University of Toronto, Marquetta Evans, she went on to be the CSR counselor for the Canadian government. So she is the go-to person. If you are a community facing a mining conflict, she's the person that you go to that's supposed to mediate that conflict between you and the company. It's absurd that a person with a vested interest in global policy would be able to, you know, brand and have a contract with strings attached to this public institution. Yeah, there's definitely a huge revolving door here. And, I mean, no one's really questioned how much Harper just... you know, toes the corporate line. I mean, so much so that I feel like he's almost taken away our ability to be shocked and appalled, you know, because every week it seems like something else absurd that he's passing. Before it was the Canadian Pension Plan and Export Development Canada that had billions of dollars invested in Canadian mining around the world. Now, international aid is going to support Canadian mining. And Julian Fantino, who's the ex-police chief of Toronto. The ex-police chief of Toronto is now the Minister of International Cooperation and is heading the department which governs all of our international aid. It's absurd, you know, and it kind of brings forth like the different parallels of, you know, these like neoliberal governments, how they're impacting, you know, poor people in the third world. Well, these are the same people that are screwing over the poor in this country, you know, and the native people in this country. And so it's very much all connected to the corruption of our government and also to the power of these huge, you know, multinational corporations.
Could you talk a little bit in specifics about the role CETA plays, for example, in supporting development projects that put a happy face on the mining industry for Canada?
Sure. Oh. And actually, just to do a little plug, so MISIN, or the Mining and Justice Solidarity Network, for long, is doing a month of events and actions and things like that. And one of them is actually going to be called Digging Up the Dirt, How Canadian Foreign Aid Supports the Mining Industry. And so that's going to be a panel that's really exploring this at length. But what basically happens is that, you know, international aid goes towards a project that, you know, CETA puts money into it, the mining company puts money into it, so the mining company gets to claim some credit for whatever they do, and also, you know, NGOs, so-called development NGOs will work on it. And what they'll do is they'll build a school next to a mining-impacted community. Or, you know, they'll work on, you know, whatever, like community projects next to a mine. And the idea is that, you know, they're trying to, in a sense, like bribe the community to get the social license to operate. But where that's really dangerous is the fact that in lots of these communities, there's existing conflict. Brendan just told the story of how the community leader that was opposed to mining was assassinated. Well, just this Tuesday, I went to an event where another amazing woman from El Salvador, Vidalina, was speaking out. And four people in her community were assassinated one by one as each stepped up to the plate to oppose mining. You know, the first one was found, at the bottom of a well, missing all of his fingernails and toenails. You know, a priest was driven off the road because he was, speaking out against the mining. Then this other guy that was speaking out against mining was shot 7 times. He survived, identified his killer, then 6 months later they came back to kill him, even though he was watched by human rights observers, 24 hours a day. So, you know, there's absolute impunity with these companies. And when this happens and you have, you know, the Canadian government supporting a development project there, who's going to speak out? You know, who's going to speak out when protesters get killed? As has been happening in Peru, where CETA is partnering up with Barrick to support these CSR projects. They want to eliminate any independent voice with any power, with any connection to Canada. And what's especially sinister is at the same time that CETA is sponsoring these mining projects, basically, corporate social responsibility projects in mining communities, CETA defunded Kairos. They defunded development and peace. And remember those religious groups I was telling you about earlier that worked on mining issues? That was them. Everyone working on mining issues from a justice perspective, from an advocacy perspective, got defunded by CETA. At the same time, they're giving millions of dollars to these, you know, corporate-sponsored projects.
We have a lot more to talk about. I want to take a break to play a song. So I'm wondering if, Brendan, do you want to introduce
sure.
a song?
And yeah, sure. So I guess like the most, like this Lies would be, this like that's basically like our single off the album. In terms of like the activist kind of awareness, lyrical content, the whole album has kind of that context, but Lies specifically has an awesome story because what happened was We met with a priest, Father Terry, who kind of is like the heart of this organization that I was telling you about. He was at our orientation before we left for the Philippines, and Ramona, the woman that we stayed with, sent him a letter to kind of brief us before we headed over to the Philippines. And everything that I learned from Father Terry telling me, like relaying Ramona's message, I jotted down all these facts and emailed them the last opportunity that I had to email to my band member. And I said, this is what we're going to write the song about. And he turned it into what is now the actual lyrics on the song. But anyways, Lies is a track that is specific to the case in the Philippines, my experience there, and kind of the struggles that the people are experiencing there.
So this is Lies by Sly.
Lies by Sly.
Yeah.
Hey, welcome back to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. We actually have a site you can go to now, www.afterthecollapse.net. And we are at the telephone booth gallery at 3148 Dundas Street West. They were kind enough to let us record our show today here. We are with Sakura Saunders and Brendan Soares, and we are here talking about mining. We were talking about some of the policies that are in place that allow Canadian companies to work with impunity in other countries.
Another thing that's happening right now, there's a bill called Bill C-323, and that is kind of like an alien torts law for Canada. And alien torts is a law that exists in the United States. Do you guys know it?
This is the Peter Julian bill?
Yes, the Peter Julian bill. So, do you want to talk about alien torts? Okay. Well, alien torts, alien, foreign, right? Torts is a French word for harm. So what alien torts laws do is they allow people that have their human rights abused outside of the country to use the court system in the country, like let's say the United States, to sue. It's funny because it's kind of a leftover law from the pirate days. You know, I mean, not that we're not living in the pirate days today, but when this was a bigger deal and, you know, how are we going to govern international waters and abuses that happened there? So it's been used in the last 30 years to bring lawsuits against multinational corporations. And so Peter Julian's bill is like this. It basically says, you know, if you're abusing human rights abroad, you can sue in Canadian courts to kind of get some reprieve, you know, some form of justice.
And there are groups currently trying to sue Canadian companies, aren't there?
Yes. Klippenstein's is an amazing law firm located in Toronto, and they've done a number of cases.
And what's your relationship with them? Do you have any formal relationship at all?
Not a formal relationship.
Just an admiration?
Possibly a mutual admiration. Mm-hmm. But we know them very well because, you know, the group of people working on these issues isn't enormous. We all know each other. And Klippenstein's does amazing work. So they've been involved in a number of lawsuits. One, there's this incredible movie documenting it. It's called Under Rich Earth. This incredible community in Ecuador had, people have been trying to mine their lands forever, and they've been resisting it. 30 years ago, there was a Japanese mining company that came there, and the community burnt down their mining camp. Well, no one was there. No one was harmed, but it was a good way of saying, you know, if you want to invest in this project, prepare to lose a lot of money, and they left. Then this other Canadian mining company, Copper Mesa is what they were called, they came in and wanted to mine. And what they did was they started, you know, putting money into the political system and trying to corrupt politicians and run their own candidates. And they also hired a paramilitary force to intimidate the community. And so what the community did, they were really smart, and they set up a road blockade to stop this paramilitary force and the mining company workers to come into the community. The mine didn't exist yet. And so they set up this blockade, and of course the paramilitary force comes out and fires pepper spray at them, shoots guns at them, and they were prepared. They got it all on videotape. Then they write a letter to the Toronto Stock Exchange, basically saying, by allowing this company to raise money on your stock exchange, you are endangering our community, because this is what the company is doing with that money. They're hiring a paramilitary force to shoot at us. Then they organized a pre-dawn raid of the mining camp. They were all armed, and they mass arrested that paramilitary force, took them by surprise.
Wow.
Held them in a church for multiple days, disarmed everyone individually and on camera, and wouldn't let them go until they all signed a statement saying that they did work for the mining company and they would never work for the mining company again. So I kind of, spoiler alert, sorry about that. It's a really great movie. I recommend watching it anyway. But
we can cut that out.
No. Okay. Don't. Leave it. It's a good story. So Klippenstein's proceeded to sue for $10 billion the Toronto Stock Exchange on behalf of this community. Eventually, they kind of lost. I mean, it got into courts, and it was thrown out of courts. It was into courts, it was thrown out of courts. And, you know, eventually it remained out of courts. but they caused the Toronto Stock Exchange a big enough headache that they delisted the company. So they basically destroyed that company with this tactic, although they didn't win the legal victory in the Canadian courts. It was eventually thrown out, which is why we need Bill C-323. And now, similarly, they have a case against Hudbay Minerals for gang rapes that occurred during forced evictions in Guatemala, the assassination by the head of security of Hudbay, the assassination of a prominent community leader, Adolfo Ich, and the paralyzing of another community member.
It's interesting bringing up the reaction to the Toronto Stock Exchange was in part to distance himself from what is abusive or immoral behavior. Whereas in the mining communities themselves, or the mining companies themselves, it seems it's more or less the standard. The great poet and activist Ed Sanders once wrote that there seems to be something about extraction that makes it impossible to do humanely. But that is unique to all industries somehow. It remains a throwback to the time before there were labor laws, and it's not just in indigenous or displaced communities, but in Harlan, Kentucky, all kinds of documentable cases where even within the Western powers, mining doesn't seem to operate by the same set of rules. And I wonder, working on the issues so deeply for so long, if you have a sense of what does separate it from the remainder of also multinational, multi-billion-dollar corporations that operate with less impunity under the same structures?
Well, I think, you know, one reason why you see a lot of abuse is because these corporations are huge, very powerful. And like I said, they're negotiating directly with usually central governments. You know, so these are huge multi-billion dollar investments that are all figured out and the money's all raised for everything before the community's even consulted. You know? And so you get that sort of situation. It's also very destructive, right, to the environment. It causes a lot of pollution. So there's a good chance that the community probably doesn't want it. You know, here you'll get some communities that agree to mining because they have to sign impact benefit agreements and things like that, and you know, it's a calculation. But those aren't really signed in these other countries as much. And even here, you'll get lots of times communities still not wanting these mining projects. So, if you don't want something, but somebody else has billions of dollars saying that that thing is going to happen, that's going to create a conflict.
Maybe you can talk a bit about your decision to work with Missin for your placement, as opposed to an NGO or a larger organization. One of the kind of splits is that there are these larger bodies that do more limited kind of less radical work, but see themselves as making a difference to the degree they can, given the constraints on the ground. And so I wonder what attracts you to the kind of work less approved, less structured, less arguably at different times less impactful, but what attracts you to this work as opposed to that?
Yeah, well, basically for me, like, I admired the fact that Mining and Justice Solidarity Network was like a volunteer organization, right? Because, like I said, like, I'm a musician, I'm in school, and I wanted to be part of something that was more like where I could relate to the rest of the members, you know? Like, if I were to have gone, like, say, with Mining Watch or something like that, I just kind of feared, like, the structure of it, because, like I said, like, I'm a musician primarily, you know, and I didn't want to, like, just the idea of it being a grassroots organization and just people doing it because they cared about it, as opposed to they're doing it because it's their job and they're making money, you know, it just, like, triggered it for me, you know, being, like, more of, like, a personable, I'm a very, like, personable person, I guess, you know, like, I like getting in there and doing, like, the hands-on kind of work, which it seems that Missin does more so than the NGOs, you know, like, I'm not really interested in the office type stuff. I admired the fact that Missin gets out on the street and does, like, actions and protests and stuff like that, and that's what kind of drew me towards their work, as opposed to alternatives within Toronto, I guess.
And just this opportunity to put another plug in for our Mining Injustice, our Spring into Action month of events from mid-April to mid-May. You can look out for solidarityresponse.net. And just something that I wanted to say, you know, related to what Brendan's saying, is that we really try to work with where people are coming from. I came to Toronto and I was all about protesting Barrick Gold, because that's where I had contacts with the communities that were directly impacted. And, you know, we believe we only take on cases where we have an actual person-to-person relationship with the community that's directly impacted. But I realize that there's people here that want to work on these issues that have their own community connections. And I wanted to create a kind of network that would kind of build off of their connections and build off of their passions. And so when Brendan came to our group, we really encouraged him to develop in a way that he could bring back knowledge and information to the Philippines community and also have an opportunity to talk about his experience and bring attention to that issue here, which is why we picked the Peruvian film to show at both his school and also on the 19th, we're going to focus on this really amazing case study in Peru. And I don't know if you want to talk a little bit about why you wanted to do this particular screening.
Yeah, just to also add on to what was previously said, and just to support what Sakura just said, is just like the fact that with working with Misson, I could kind of like dictate my own
journey.
Yeah, exactly. Like I can come into Misson because it's volunteer based, and like she said, they're open to suggestions, and you know, I could kind of create my own work based on my own experience and what I want to see happen for the community context that I have, you know. Whereas if I were to work with like an NGO or something, I can't necessarily just walk in and say, okay, I'm your intern and this is what I want to focus on and this is what my projects are going to be, right? It kind of allowed me the level of it offered me an opportunity to kind of work on the things that I was passionate about, basically. Like I could focus on the things that I've experienced and the things that I want to achieve. And Misson was just like, it's just a perfect environment for that kind of thing. Like as she said, if you somehow have experienced something by working with Misson, it kind of gives you a platform to kind of build off of what you're trying to create or to build upon, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So,
okay, before we start talking about the Peru event, I think it's time to play another song.
Mm-hmm.
So if you could introduce what that would be.
Well, if cussing isn't a problem, then we might as well play a track called Bling Is Dead. And it's kind of funny, we're all like promoting our own like music projects, but my partner is a hip-hop artist, and he is a conscious hip-hop artist. And so, of course, something that really disturbs him about hip-hop culture is the materialism, you know, and bling culture. And so he made a song called Bling Is Dead, this one, and you know it's all about how, you know, we shouldn't honor this like materialist culture, and in fact gold mining is incredibly destructive, and we should strive for our own freedom and the freedom of others instead. And so here it is, Bling Is Dead by Test Their Logic, Toronto based hip hop.
Is murder, bling is dead. Fuck getting rich, get free instead. Bling is warfare, bling kills kids, a profit mercenary mining executives. Bling is murder, bling is dead. Get that chain from around your neck. Bling is pompous, bling is toxic. Bling's killing the earth, come on y'all, stop it. We don't need no more dirty gold. 20 tons of toxic waste for every ring that's sold. Exploration, devastation, earth's getting probed by Bay Street mining companies with no soul. They want it all, pillage every last inch. Blow the world to bits, turn the mountains into pits. Spilling toxic waste in the rivers, killing fish. Turn the water black, using mercenary shit. And we don't even need it, it only has value, cause we believe it. Like the money we spend, it's all fiat. And just like money, we can't eat it. Still a billion star while the minds expand. Either get displaced or die taking a stand. Colonization and every gold band, cause most gold is stolen from native land. Bling is murder, bling is dead. Fuck getting rich, get free instead. Bling is warfare. Bling kills kids, a private mercenary mining executives. Bling is murder, bling is dead. Get that chain from around your neck. Bling is pompous, bling is toxic. Bling's killing the earth, come on y'all, stop it. Yeah, for real, fuck Goldcore, fuck Barrett Gold, all these evil fucks, test their logic. Planetary killers have names and addresses. Storm their fortresses with flames, pitchforks and shit. Villains make billions, kill children. James Bling and Grace filling for these necklaces. Executives like Def Living, example Peter Maul, twin brother of the Reaper, this evil little fuck. Called Gold Digger, his soul sicker. He sold his soul for blood, blinging so warm from such sin and death bringer. For that bling on your finger, Grace getting bigger while they bringing major figures. Mercenary thugs with their fingers on the trigger. It's murder, death, kill for a little bit of glitter. What's sicker than bling? It's blood and violence for gold and diamonds. Death, they're mining. Are you reminded of all those that were killed for some stupid shiny rock all up in your grill? Bling is murder, bling is dead. Fuck getting rich, get free instead. Bling is warfare, bling kills kids, a profit mercenary mining executives. Bling is murder, bling is dead. Get that chain from around your neck. Bling is pompous, bling is toxic. Bling's killing the earth, come on y'all, stop it.
Grassroots communities around the world are rising up against gold mining, one of the most destructive types of mining in the world today. It creates mountains of waste, poisons massive amounts of water, and targets indigenous peoples and rural poor. Bling only serves to enforce vanity and a sense of security in the rich. Rise up against the Earth Destroyers. Support movements for self-determination and mining justice worldwide.
Welcome back to After the Collapse. That was Bling is Dead by Test Their Logic. And we are here at the Telephone Booth Gallery, which is located at 3148 Dundas Street West. A great art gallery. We recommend that you come here, not just for the great art, but because they're so kind and pleasant and allowed us to record the show here today.
The paintings are very hauntingly beautiful, though.
Jim Vernon and I are here. This is After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. You can go to afterthecollapse.net to learn more about us. And we're here with Sakura Saunders and Brendan Soares, and we are talking about mining rights, and we are going to learn a bit about a Peru event.
So basically what's going on is we have two film screenings that are kind of showcasing what's going on in Peru right now. Basically, the reason why I chose to kind of highlight Peru's case is because I had the pleasure of meeting a man named Ulysses Garcia, who is a Peruvian from a community that is affected by mining, and he's here in Canada advocating and building awareness as to what's going on down in Peru. And basically what he's done is he's organized these community consultas or referendums, which he's basically expressing the community's opposition.
Yeah, Ulysses' personal story is incredible. And he's actually going to be present at these events that we're hosting. So again, miningandjusticesn.wordpress.com is one of the websites you can go to find out more about this series of events. But his dad was murdered in front of him by... His dad was the leader. He was El Ingeniero, is what everyone would call him, the engineer in the community. That would always just go on and on about how stupid this project was, and everyone in the community loved him. And... they killed him and made Ulysses drive the getaway vehicle and then abandoned the vehicle and ran away. And then Ulysses became one of the leaders in the community. The whole community was against the mine, and they had a referendum where 95% of them voted against the mine. And because it was such a well-coordinated referendum with international observers, international press, they were successful in kicking out that mining company. And ever since, Ulysses has gone on to go into communities that aren't his own, that are struggling against mining companies, and organize these consultas, and organize for the international press to show up. And, you know, it would be really cool if, you know, when Brendan, you know, goes back and shows the community the film translated into Filipino, which I believe it is, actually, the same film that we're going to screen, that they might be inspired by that. And if they are inspired by that, well, then we now are very close to Ulysses to get his advice on how to do something like that.
How simple or how effective is a simple act like refusing to buy jewelry? What kind of an impact is the anti-bling movement would it have on the worldwide quest for gold and cost of gold?
Well, it's actually interesting. Gold mining is one of the most explored for. Gold is one of the most explored for substances. 50% of all mineral exploration is for gold because it's so damn expensive. But its practical uses are few. Less than 11% of gold is used for anything other than jewelry or investment. And the vast majority of it actually goes to jewelry. So it is this weird luxury item that causes so much devastation. I mean, and gold is very symbolic of this theft of land and, you know, colonization and you know, all of this really gross stuff. I mean, I always say that, like, gold, which used to be known to make man crazy, has now evolved into a completely insane industry that produces a million times more waste than product, which is gold. So,
it's interesting that we hear so much about its role in industry and how vital gold is to the economy with the new electronic-based economy, but it seems to play virtually no role in the gold market that actually
exactly.
Uses electronics.
Yes, I mean, maybe 10% is used for electronics, maybe. Of that 11%, that's the other category. And we get about 37% of our gold supply from recycled sources. So you wouldn't need to mine any gold, and you could still use it for almost four times the electronics that we produce currently. And we produce a lot of electronics these days. So I think that, you know, culturally, creating a culture that rejects gold, that associates gold with this sort of disgusting wealth, this, you know, one of my favorite capitalist things, and again, you can cuss on this program, so I'll say it, you don't have to fuck people over to survive, you know? And gold is just that, you know? It's fucking other people over, usually poor, marginalized, large, majority indigenous people, so that you can have a shiny little thing to wear, ornament to wear, and or so that you can hold on to your wealth, you know, past the grave, you know, so that you can have all these pursuits that, you know, should be frowned on as really, like, antisocial behavior. So I think that there's a lot of cultural work to do, but I think that the main work, you know, is going to be done by these communities resisting mining. And they're the ones that have this huge struggle in front of them. And in supporting them, it's almost like we're just trying to stop the counter-revolution. You know? When we organize, we're just trying to make it so that people speaking out against mining can have enough public support that the company wouldn't dare targetedly assassinate them. You know? And it's really nice that people like Vitalina from El Salvador, after four of our community members were assassinated, you know, and they were the leaders, you know, they weren't just random people, they were the leaders, that she's doing these speaking tours of Canada. And she hasn't been assassinated yet, so hopefully it's working, you know. But that's kind of what we hope for. We're trying to support these struggles. We do fundraisers, you know, when something like a consulta happens, they need money, so lots of the money that we've raised has gone towards, like, just hiring a bus to get people to the vote or things like that, you know. So there's little material ways that we can also support the struggles. But, you know, showing up, voicing your opposition, we need to create a culture here in Toronto that really shames these companies, that says that behavior is unacceptable and antisocial, and we are watching you. We know what's going on. We see through your CSR spin, your public relations, you know, this business about jobs and sustainable mining or whatever. And it's really important. And once we get to the point where the culture rejects mining, then you'll see these community struggles be more and more successful. You know, right now, only about 30% of the consultas that Ulysses helps organize, all of them are successful in getting like the vast majority of people to vote against the mine. Only 30% of them are successful in actually kicking out the mining company. And at this point, that is the craziest, most successful tactic that we have. Mm-hmm. You know, so the stories of the community winning are few and far between considering the number of conflicts that we hear about. But there's hope, because with increased awareness, we expect the companies to be getting away with less. I was shocked when I came here the first time. I mean, that's why I actually moved back for a month and a half that August. I took time off work and just was here for a month and a half. I was like, wow, you know, to be a progressive, you know, Canadian means that you have a solid critique of the U.S. government. Yet nobody even knows how horrible their mining companies are abroad. No one even knows that Canada's the leader in mining. And now, you know, 6 years later, I think most people just take it as an assumption that Canadian... Lots of people take it as an assumption that Canadian mining companies are probably doing bad things, you know? And that changes the how you're supposed to act. It's not just about awareness anymore. Now it's about actually transforming that awareness into action. You know, so with the movie screenings that we're doing, we're going to be raising money for Ulysses' organization to be doing these consultas. And they're really interesting, engaging stories. I mean, this amazing, coordinated, intelligent community resistance that is really inspiring. So I really recommend going to see these movies. And then the action component, you know, actually going to these protests, actually marching on the doorstep when the boards of directors are all there meeting and shaming them. And we need all the people we can for that, because the fact is that I don't think we've ever had a protest with more than 200 people. And I would like to see that grow, just because I think psychologically, you know, when they see 20 people outside in the protest, then 30 people outside next year, 30 people next year, you know, 50 people next year, 100 people, you know, I want the numbers to grow as the consciousness grows, of people that are actually willing to take time off their busy schedules and stand in solidarity. I think it's so important that people just express their solidarity in this country. And that's why this year we're not doing a conference. It's the first year we haven't done a conference, because we're like, you guys know enough. Now we want to see you on the streets. And we're doing a number of AGM protests. Barrick Gold is having their annual general meeting on the 24th. Goldcorp on the May 2nd, and Hudbay, that, you know, actually both Barrick Gold and Hudbay are both gang-raping mining companies. They're going to have their AGM on May 10th. And Hudbay, of course, right now is even suing a Manitoba First Nation community, Cree community there, for protesting.
Sakura Saunders and Brendan Soares, thank you both for enlightening us and informing us, and we wish you all the best with what you're doing with the Mining and Justice Solidarity Network and your other endeavors. You've been listening to After the Collapse on RadioRegent.com. Jim, say something.
Thank you to the Telephone Booth Gallery for hosting us this week.
Yes, the Telephone Booth Gallery at 3148 Dundas Street West. We are going to list all of the websites that were mentioned in this program on www.afterthecollapse.net. Thank you.